Good morning. Welcome back to Focus 580. This is hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with James Carroll about his new book, a book that's getting a lot of attention. It's titled House of War, and the subtitle is The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. You certainly should be able to find it in the bookstores. It is a book that is both a very personal story for the author, James Carroll, and also a look at the defense establishment in the United States and the role that it has played in making American foreign policy. It's also about the Pentagon in both a very literal and perhaps more metaphorical sense, something that the guest, James Carroll, has had a real personal involvement with. When he was a boy, in fact, he spent a lot of time in the Pentagon with his dad, who was a general in the Air Force. During the Vietnam War, he came back to the Pentagon, this time as a protester. And given the fact that he had perhaps very mixed feelings about the place, he says that he was actually surprised by the grief that he felt after the attack on the Pentagon of 9/11, and that those feelings, perhaps, in part at least, made him want to dig a little bit deeper into the history of the place, and the result is this book, The House of War. Our guest, James Carroll, was born in 1943 in Chicago. He was, in fact, interestingly enough, born the very same week that the Pentagon building was dedicated in 1943. He grew up in Washington, where his father was a general in the Air Force and also served as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Carroll went to Georgetown University before entering the seminary to train for the Catholic priesthood. He was ordained as a priest in 1969. He served as the Catholic chaplain of Boston University from 1969 until 1974, after which he left the priesthood to become a writer. He published his first novel in 1976 and since has published nine others. He wrote a memoir, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us, and that book received a number of honors, including the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 1996. His book, Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, A History, was published in 2001, sold very well, also received a number of awards. It was named one of the best books of 2001 by the LA Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and other publications. And I do want to mention just one more book that also has been well received, a book that he wrote in response to the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. This is a book entitled Toward a New Catholic Church, The Promise of Reform. Our guest is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk with James Carroll, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call with their questions. Mr. Carroll, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm honored to be speaking with you.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. It seems that almost any discussion of the book and the larger issues do have to begin, as you do, with some of your own history and your own connection to the place that, as I explained, it does indeed comes through your dad, who worked there in the building. So when you were a boy, you apparently spent a lot of time at the Pentagon.
Well, it's true. My dad took great pleasure in letting me tag along with him, I think on Saturdays probably, almost certainly. When I was a boy in the late 40s, early 50s, I remember vividly the pleasure, the secret pleasure it was to step out of my shoes and slide down the broad ramps in my stocking feet. I remember having the run of the place. Obviously, it was a different world then, and security was much more casual than it is now. As a high school student, I went to high school in Washington, and my folks, we lived in Virginia, and the Pentagon, as it happened, was about halfway home in my daily commute, and I often stopped off at the Pentagon. I would check in at my dad's office. His secretary would tell me what time to come back, when he'd be ready to leave, and I would take off, and I'd find a corner in which to do my homework, and then sometimes I would just explore the place. It was a wonderful experience. The Pentagon, for me, embodied the virtue of the United States of America, the heroism of the generation that had defeated Hitler and were standing strong against Stalin and his successors, it represented to me all that's great about the United States. And I did get in touch with that feeling very much on September 11th, 2001. Hmm.
There was at some time in your life the thought that you would go into the military as a career?
Well, actually, yes. It was easy to imagine that as a boy growing up enthralled with the Air Force, my father's role in it. When I was a college freshman at Georgetown University, I have to say the thing I gave my greatest energy to was ROTC. I loved being an ROTC cadet. I loved the uniform. This was the early 60s. John Kennedy was president. The call to serve the country was vivid and powerful, and the Air Force seemed the perfect way to do that for me. Ironically enough, it was partly the experience, the other experience of those years, that it took me a different way, which was, I think I had a vivid sense, I don't think I was too unusual in this way, I had a vivid sense of the threat of nuclear war. I was afraid of it. I'm of that generation that spent some time under our school desks, the duck and cover drills. It was in the summer of 1961, as I remember it, that during the Berlin crisis, the United States palpably drew close to a conflict with the Soviet Union. Kennedy was threatened with war by Khrushchev, and in fact, Kennedy went on television to warn us all to build bomb shelters. And it was that summer, I think, that my father let me glimpse some of his deep concern about the threat of nuclear war. And I, as I remember it, felt a deep sense of existential anguish, and my religious faith seemed more relevant to me than ever. And it was, I think, out of that that I stepped away from my ambition to go in the Air Force and instead went into the seminary, ultimately to be ordained as a Catholic priest. The irony, of course, that I found myself drawn into the Catholic left and the Catholic peace movement, and I reshaped my sense of myself in the priesthood as a person against the war.
Mm-hmm. For someone, I think you perhaps have to be of the right age to have the kind of feelings about the Cold War and to have been living at this time where the idea of a nuclear attack was a very real possibility. And I think that you, in fact, perhaps some people might have heard the interview that ran on Morning Edition earlier this week where you told a moving story about how one night when you were driving home with your dad from the Pentagon, he said to you, "It may be that there would be a war." And he said to you, "Now, what I want you to do is you're the one who's going to be responsible for getting the rest of the family to safety. And what I want you to do is get your mother and everybody and get in the car and drive away from Washington, D.C. as fast as you possibly can." And that you went on to say that of course, was really, when you think about it now, if we were at that point, there would be no driving away. You weren't going to drive away from World War III. But at the time, that must have been an enormously, to have your father, given who he was, have him say something like to you that to you must have been enormously frightening.
It was terrifying, really. And, of course, now I understand that it was simply a manifestation of his terror. It was an irrational thought. As you say, there was no getting away. It was irrational of President Kennedy to invite us to build bomb shelters to save us for what? What I think we Americans have forgotten is how very much at the mercy of this real fear we lived as a people. And our leaders didn't hesitate to make it clear to us how dangerous that period was. And it did peak, that danger did peak in those years. It was President Kennedy coming out of the really close call of the Cuban Missile Crisis the subsequent year that he was so motivated then to put in place a different dynamic. In House of War, I'm tracking the dynamic that none of these men, they're all men, was able to really take charge of. For example, I was astounded to realize that in 1950, there were only 200 nuclear weapons in the American arsenal. And by 1960, when Kennedy took office, that number had grown to 19,000, which was appalling to Kennedy, even as he added to it. The nuclear arsenal continued to escalate at terrible levels until finally, by the time President Reagan came into office, we possessed something between 50 and 60,000 nuclear warheads. Well, it was an accumulation of destructive power that was so far beyond any rational purpose. And that accumulation itself posed an enormous danger to the world. We're just very lucky we survived it. And as I got back in touch with how afraid I was in those years, I realized that we, perhaps today, are not afraid enough. Our dread of terrorism and our dread of a repeat of 9/11 is one thing. But the absolute end of the world existential anguish tied to the possibility of nuclear war was of a different order entirely. And that possibility should have been enough itself to force us as a people to radically alter the way we were organizing ourselves in the world, and it didn't. We're still far too reliant, in my view, not only on military force, but on the centrality of our nuclear arsenal.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that certainly the major argument of the book is your feeling that the defense establishment, you know, this thing that Dwight Eisenhower so famously called the military-industrial complex, that this thing has become a driving force in American foreign policy, certainly more, and as we have seen in recent years, that perhaps the Secretary of Defense ends up speaking with a much louder voice than the Secretary of State.
Yes, it's true, although I would say it's far more than a matter of foreign policy. We hear a lot of talk about campaign finance reform, for example. We understand how lobbyists have taken our political process hostage and how beholden congressmen and senators are to special interests. Well, the vast majority of that special interest power is tied to the defense industry. What Eisenhower warned of, really he should have called it the military-industrial congressional labor, academic, media, economic complex, all the great pins of American culture go into this, well, this Pentagon culture, this Pentagon ethos. It has us by the throat as a people more than we ever recognize. It certainly affects our foreign policy, the foolish way in which we're inviting a new arms race with China and perhaps even a recovered Russia now, the way in which, well, until 2 days ago, we have shown only a face of belligerent to Iran, as if that's going to enable Iranians to negotiate with us. And, of course, the obvious epiphany of the disastrous war in Iraq, which shows us the limits of military force. All of this because, as a people, we're deeply, deeply beholden to a militarization of the core of the American system that we can barely recognize as such. The clear signal of it, of course, is our budgetary priorities, the vast treasures that go to the Defense Department compared to everything else.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Carroll. His new book is House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. He is a novelist, has written several. He's also the author of a best-selling book, Constantine's Sword. He won the National Book Award in 1996 for his memoir, An American Requiem, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a caller all the way up north in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so we'll go there. Line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning, David. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Carroll. Mr. Carroll, you just mentioned briefly Bush's attitude towards Iran, you said up until the last 2 days, but I think it even goes right up to this moment, because if you analyze what Bush's comments were about possibly negotiating with Iran, it's still stated in the form of an ultimatum. An ultimatum we know is backed up by plans that the Pentagon has to attack Iran. In fact, they're operational, according to what Seymour Hersh said in the April 17th New Yorker and various other reports since then. I'm wondering, just taking my scenario for the moment, if you will, what can the American people do to try to avoid a war with Iran? How can we force Bush to have a real dialogue and aim at reconciliation with Iran rather than war?
Well, it's a really important question. I think that you're right to suggest, imply certainly, that just because it's irrational to attempt to influence Iran by means of military force, something like an invasion even, or a bombing campaign, just because it's irrational doesn't mean it won't happen, because the history I track in House of War suggests that again and again we have pursued irrational military courses out of this impersonal momentum more than wise decisions by the people in charge. So you're right to be warning us of that. But I also think what your question draws attention to is the fact that in the United States of America, we are a democracy. We're not at the mercy of a totalitarian dictatorship system yet. And because we are a democracy, it's in the conversation of politics that we have to raise our voices. We're on the threshold of another political season with congressional elections coming up. These questions, certainly the question about our disposition toward Iran, essentially are the questions about our position in Iraq. These simply have to inform the center of political discussion. And every citizen has an obligation, in my view, to raise the questions of these serious catastrophes that are unfolding with every politician in every forum. And the media itself has an obligation to put these questions at the very center of preoccupation as we come into this political season. So that would be my single largest recommendation in response to your observation.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go on. We'll talk with someone else here in Belgium, not too far away. Line one. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much for being on the radio.
Sure. Do you have some questions for the guest?
No. No. Keep the faith.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your good wishes.
Other questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You just to go back to the time of the founding of the Pentagon as an establishment and a building at the time when, and this was during World War II, at a time when the Roosevelt administration really decided that the various pieces of the war-making apparatus needed to be physically centralized in one place. That's how it is. They decided to build this enormous building to do that.
Yes.
You say that at the time that this happened, there were a number of things that came together that were particularly critical and perhaps was the beginning of this momentum, you know, the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill that is the military-industrial complex. You talk about the setting up of the program to build the nuclear weapon. You talk about the kind of strategic bombing campaigns that were carried on in Europe and then were also later carried on in Japan. And perhaps a capping all of that is the position that Roosevelt and the Allied leaders took, that there must be in the war against the Axis powers, there must be unconditional surrender. That all of this somehow adds together to create this frame, this sort of ultimate war, extreme good and evil battle kind of way of thinking about what it was we were doing. And from there, it was we thought that way about the Germans and Japanese, and then pretty soon we were thinking that way about the Soviet Union, and now we think about that way about terrorism. And it seems that that is something, that kind of worldview is something that we have a very difficult time getting away from.
Well, it's true. You know, one of the things that strikes me, and the pleasure of doing history, is to recognize that history might have gone another way. We in America today take so for granted both the Pentagon itself as a building and the bureaucracy it represents, and the impersonal momentum of any bureaucracy of that size, we take that for granted. And we also take for granted methods of warfare that have entirely changed the meaning of our country. What I'm trying to help myself and others recognize is that it didn't have to be this way. It was unpredicted. In 1943, what the events you refer to all actually took place in 1 week. It's an astounding coincidence. The week that the Pentagon was dedicated was the week that the Allied strategic bombing campaign against Germany was initiated. Now, remember that in 1943, nobody knew yet what warfare from the air really was capable of. We didn't know yet that vast, vast, vast levels of destruction, mayhem, and death were going to be able to be delivered impersonally, easily, readily, by the push of a button. We couldn't have anticipated what a revolution in human consciousness, strategic bombing, would represent. And match that together with the other technological revolution that was launched that week, with the full establishment of Los Alamos. So strategic bombing and the atomic bomb, both established in the same week, at the same moment, as you recall, as you just recalled for us, that Roosevelt announced the policy of unconditional surrender. He could not have known what unconditional surrender would do in the last weeks of the war, when the United States Air Force, by then almost only the United States Air Force, in its campaign against Japan from the air, first killed through bombing hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians, and then that culminated, of course, in the dropping of the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that by August of 1945, a revolution had occurred in the meaning of violence. And no one in America could possibly have anticipated that. But there it was. And the question then became, what do we do about it? Well, by then, as I argue, a momentum had been unleashed by the confluence of these forces. And even though men, and again they were men, tried to stem this momentum, they weren't able to do so. So it blew right through those early years of the Cold War, through the Cold War, even past the end of the Cold War. The great revelation comes when Americans ask, how is it that the Cold War ended, our Cold War enemy disappeared, and yet our Cold War arsenal, our Cold War levels of defense spending, and our Cold War mindset, us against them, all of that remained intact even without the Cold War. How did that happen? And the answer is because of this impersonal, unchecked dynamic that is generated in the Pentagon still.
Hmm. And I think you certainly have been, are in the book, very critical of almost all of the presidents from Franklin Roosevelt forward, and it wouldn't matter if they were Democrats or Republicans, conservatives, liberals. I think your argument is that really no president has ever made a serious effort to check, to rein in the power of this thing, the military industrial complex.
Well, there's one exception to that, at least a partial exception to it, and people might be surprised to hear me say this, but if there's a hero in this story, it's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, the Hawk of Hawks, who did put in place the kind of capstone of the military system with his huge escalations in military spending in his first term. But the great turn in the story comes when, by some fluke of history, the person who comes to power on the other side, the Soviet Union, is someone who responds to the collapse of the Soviet economy not by striking out at an enemy abroad as collapsing tyrants have always done in the past. No, Gorbachev responded to what he was faced with by moving to dismantle the structure of the Cold War itself and to stop the escalation of the arms race. And he found a partner in Ronald Reagan. And together they did it. They stopped the upward escalation of the arms race. They began the process of disarmament. Under Reagan and George H.W. Bush, the American nuclear arsenal was cut in half in response to what Gorbachev began. It's a tremendous story. Reagan was a nuclear abolitionist. He understood that nuclear weapons have no place on the earth. It's true that he was stymied in his impulse to eliminate nuclear weapons by his fanciful and wrong-headed attachment to the dream of the Strategic Defense Initiative. But we shouldn't forget, nevertheless, that Reagan put on the table the absolute ambition that we should eliminate nuclear weapons. And that's been taken off the table by Reagan's successors, which is why I remember him with a certain nostalgia, frankly.
We have another caller here to talk with. We're just a little bit past our midpoint, by the way. Our guest is James Carroll. His new book is House of War. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Questions and comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have that toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Spring Bay. It's line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Very interesting conversation. I'd like to add to it by you caused me to remember that I believe it was the 4th century B.C. the Athenians attacked a preemptive war in the northern to the northern parts of Greece because they were concerned and worried that their food supply was going to be cut off. They had to import all of their food. And it's my opinion that we are locked into a similar preemptive war for oil now. That's the food of our economy. And all of our militarization, the way I see it, is really involved in this resource of oil. And we've sort of given up the attempt at getting this resource through diplomacy and cooperation. And we're now locked in a battle for it through the military. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, you remind us that the impulse to defend and to strike goes deep into human history. It's part of the human condition. Every act of offense has generated some act of defense, which in turn generates an escalated act of offense and so on. And you're right to invite us to have the long view about this. But I'm arguing in House of War that something new is at work today that actually renders the entire tradition of defense and offense irrelevant, and that's the capacity of human beings to absolutely destroy themselves as a species. That's what weapons of mass destruction mean. And they're so readily available, they're so easily obtained at this point, that only new responses the traditional experiences of threat and fear of the other will enable us to survive as a people. I may seem like a completely foolish, soft-headed idealist when I say war itself is the question now, but I argue that realists have consistently gotten this question wrong since the beginning of the nuclear age, and it's the realists who've missed the bigger picture. The realists entirely missed the real significance of the arms race, which is why they were so resigned to it, and then the realists entirely missed the significance of the democracy movements behind the Iron Curtain and the peace movements on this side of the Iron Curtain. It's the realist appeal to the ancient traditions of war and war making that is the real threat to us now. We have to think in a new way, and that's the basic point I've come to in this book.
Well, I would agree with you, and I guess the point that I was making was that the motivator for all of this bad behavior these days, I think, is energy, oil, and that we do need to start to look at cooperative programs and diplomacy to figure out a way that this resource can be allocated in a mature and meaningful way. I'll get off and...
Well, I certainly take your central point about oil. If I don't land there first in my response to you, it's because if it weren't the jealous need we have of oil, if it weren't that motivating our military impulses, it would be something else. It was really only with Jimmy Carter and the Carter Doctrine that we began to militarize our approach to oil resources. I think that energy is crucial today, and you're absolutely right that we have to attend to our careless approach to energy. But I'm actually suggesting that something deeper is at work here. And there's something basic about a fear of the American fear of Islam, that was generated and given such powerful expression in response to 9/11 clearly, in my view, is rooted in Western civilization's ancient fear of Islam, going right back to the Crusades. It was not insignificant when the image of the Crusade popped into President Bush's mind that day. The European civilization defined itself over against Islam in a very powerful way 1,000 years ago, and the very structure of our minds is rooted there. Oil is the latest instance of a point of contention between us. But if it weren't for oil, it would be something else.
I wonder if we could return to, for a moment, to the matter of the Cold War and the nuclear, the threat of nuclear weapons. And I wonder how you react to the argument that certainly some people will make that, in fact, it was the presence of nuclear weapons that kept the Cold War from going hot. That is, the principle of mutual assured destruction meant that neither side could contemplate the use of those weapons because the consequences for both sides would be disastrous.
Well, it there's a certain common sense that's undeniable in that observation. I mean, the fact is the Cold War did end without the nuclear conflagration. And it's also certainly true that both sides had absolute reasons not to strike the other because of the recognition that they would be destroyed in turn. So it's impossible at one level to argue with that. But when that's put forward as a justification for nuclear weapons or the nuclear arsenal, it becomes perverse. We survived that confrontation, as Robert McNamara put it to me and I think to others, by sheer dumb luck. It was not an achievement of statesmanship. It was sheer dumb luck that we survived the nuclear standoff with the Soviet Union. And the urgency, once one fully takes that in, then there's no possibility of a complacent acceptance of nuclear weapons or the theory of deterrence. The theory of deterrence is a moral disaster for us. Think about what it actually means. It means that if we were to take a devastating strike that was destroying us as a people, our last act as a people would be to launch an equivalent strike against someone else, perhaps endangering the entire species. Our readiness to, we built our national policy around our readiness to do that. That's had a terrible deadening effect on the American soul, in my view. And it's a system out from under which we have yet to come. We're still at the mercy of deterrence. With thousands of nuclear weapons, we have got to reckon with this. We have to reckon with its moral meaning, but we also have to reckon with its practical danger. There's something deeply wrongheaded in the train of thought that concludes with a kind of complacent acceptance of the status quo, which is, of course, today's conventional wisdom.
Let's take another call. This is someone listening in Elgin, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Look forward to reading your book, but I'd like to ask a question or two and perhaps make a comment. One of the comments I was about to make was made by your host just now. But the first question I'd like to ask is whether you're a pacifist, and if not, whether there is any time when war is acceptable. So, for example, tying into that thought, if the Iranians were to go ahead and develop nuclear weapons, would it ever be right for the United States to use force to stop them from doing so? Mm-hmm. A comment I'd like to make is that I grew up in Europe, in Italy, actually, in the Cold War in the 50s. And frankly, I'm somewhat happy that the United States had this nuclear capability because, after all, I think that helped not only save Western Europe from Soviet dictatorship, but allowed for the development of, later on, democratic movements in the Soviet Union and its satellites as well. Those are my thoughts and questions.
Well, let me take them in order and try to give you a succinct reply. First of all, I'm not a pacifist. I do accept the label peacenik. In the nuclear age, I do believe that war between nations is inevitably going to be lead to worse conditions, not better ones. But that doesn't mean I don't see the point in the necessity at times of military force. What I believe is that the time has come for international structures of law to replace ad hoc nationalist wars. After 9/11, when al-Qaeda struck the United States so brutally and left us so traumatized, it seemed very clear to me that a forceful, yes, violent response was essential. But it should have been a forceful, very forceful enforcement of the law. It should have been carried out. The al-Qaeda should have been carefully targeted by a system of international police forces working together in alliance with each other. Instead, what we did was we fell back on a 19th century nationalist impulse to go to war in the name of one nation, which inevitably condemned us to be understood as a nation reaching for empire, which is exactly how much of the rest of the world understands America today. If instead of going to war on our own against first Afghanistan and then Iraq, we had, for example, taken full advantage of the brand new International Criminal Court, a system which had just come into being at that moment, but which the Bush administration had just repudiated. If we had taken advantage of the International Criminal Court as the place in the context of which to bring Osama bin Laden to justice, he might be in custody today. Don't forget what happened. We went to war, and bin Laden escaped, and al-Qaeda is more powerful than ever. We've turned Iraq into a recruiting ground for al-Qaeda. War has made our situation worse, not better. Forceful enforcement of the law is what I'm calling for. And the Cold War itself could have been a first instance of that. I'm not naive enough to think that Joseph Stalin didn't have imperial ambitions, whether they were the totalitarian, spiritual, Manichaean ambitions described by anti-communists in the West is a different question, but he certainly was a tyrant to be resisted, to be contained, and ultimately to be defeated. And my argument is that too could have gone another way. But right at the beginning of the Cold War, the great structure of international law, of international cooperation, a move away from 19th century notions of nationalism that are always self-defeating, the great structure of international law, the United Nations, was still born because the United States, at least this is one key factor, the United States refused to yield in any way its sovereignty over the atomic bomb. So, no, I'm not a pacifist. But yes, I think the time to move away from structures of war and towards structures of international law has come, and the lessons of the Cold War reinforce that position, I argue. But very clearly, the lessons of this failed war in Iraq make it mandatory.
What lessons are there for the Iranian situation?
Well, the Iranians are taking their cues from us. George W. Bush wants a restored nuclear arsenal, has announced his plan to resume productions of nuclear weapons, and to continue to base American power in the world on the threat of using nuclear weapons against people. We're even capable of threatening to use nuclear weapons against Iran. Well, how do we expect Iran to respond to such a set of ultimata? Iran is playing by our playbook. My argument is, if the United States took the lead in serious steps against nuclear proliferation, the first step being a renunciation of our own nuclear arsenal, an immediate move, for example, from the thousands of warheads we have now down to a level of 200 or 300, which would be more than enough to maintain our policy of deterrence. If we were to do that, and by the way, until a decade or so ago, that had become a kind of conventional wisdom, even in the Pentagon. If we were to do that, that would send a signal that even the Iranians would hear loud and clear. There's no future for nuclear weapons in the world. We have the time has come to get rid of them. We're inviting Iran to behave in exactly the opposite way. Iran is acting reasonably in a very perverse way by trying to get a nuclear weapon, because only a nuclear weapon is going to make Iran immune from our capacity to threaten them militarily. It's the lesson they've already learned from North Korea, of course.
No, thank you.
No, thanks for the call. I suppose that there's certainly people who would make the argument that, just as you just outlined, that's the commitment that we made in signing on to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Indeed. So Clause 6 of that treaty obliges us by law to work for the elimination of nuclear weapons. We're in violation of the law.
And that is the bargain that we offer non-nuclear countries for not going nuclear.
Exactly right. And Iranians point this out in the international fora all the time. You hardly ever hear it in the United States. Iranians complaining that we're in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that we insist they adhere to. Well, we're in violation of it, so why shouldn't they be? That's their simple question. And it's not a bad question.
Our guest is James Carroll. He is a novelist and journalist. As he explained at the beginning of the program, grew up in Washington. His father was a general in the Air Force and was the first director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Also, as he explained, his concerns growing up during time of the Cold War led him into a religious career. He was ordained as a priest. He served as the Catholic chaplain of Boston University from 69 to 74, and after that he left the priesthood to become a writer. He has published a number of novels, a memoir which received the National Book Award in nonfiction, also a book that got a lot of attention and a lot of awards, a book that looks at the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Jews. That book is Constantine's Sword, and his newest is House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power, published by Houghton Mifflin. We do have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in, I believe, in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, two short comments and then a question, and then I'll hang up. You were saying that the Iranians were acting rationally. That brings to mind that Ehud Barak was quoted as saying that if he was born Palestinian, he would have joined a terrorist organization himself. I wonder if he'd go so far as to say the same thing about the Palestinians, that they're acting rationally. Another comment is that isn't it clear that our ideas of freedom often entail not caring about the interests of others, and that's a big source of a lot of our problems. But what I wanted to ask you about was, since you wrote that book about the Catholic Church's relationship to Jews, I was wondering what your reaction was to the Mearsheimer and Walt article, the Israel Lobby, where they mentioned the Pentagon and the groups that were influenced by the Israel Lobby or maybe to put it another way, to what extent do you think lobbyists with strong foreign interests have been able to influence the Pentagon? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, it's a whole range of interesting and important points of reference. On the question of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, my simple view is that human tragedy consists in two sides in diehard opposition to each other, each one of which is right. The Palestinian people have a clear right to their land, their legacy, their economy now, and their future. And the Israeli occupation is making all of that impossible. Israel has a clear right to its security, its borders, its standing as a Jewish state. And Jews have a clear right to be at home in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem. These two diametrically opposed positions are being played out in this terrible conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And I think Barak's comment that you refer to is a clear indication of his capacity to see the other side. My own view, of course, is that because of our American emphasis on military solutions, we keep making things worse. Imagine what the situation among and between Israelis and Palestinians would be today if instead of spending the tens of billions of dollars that we've spent in Iraq over the last 3 years, if instead we had used that money to create a new Palestinian economy, giving Palestinian young people a reason to live and a reason to hope and a reason to believe in the future, the world would be very different, and the Israelis and the Palestinians would not be at each other's throats. Suicide bombing is a moral disaster, and the grip that violence has on the Palestinian soul at this point, in my view, is a terrible, terrible tragedy. Israel has, in my view, reason for its defensiveness and its sense of being under siege, especially when there does now come the possibility of a nuclear-armed Iran, with Iran explicitly making genocidal threats against the people of Israel. All of that, of course, does have impact on American politics, and the Mearsheimer Wald paper that you refer to was an attempt to address all of that in its context in American politics. In my view, the mistake that that paper actually made was its uncritical and unnuanced use of the idea of the lobby. It evoked, in my reading, echoes of the way in which the word cabal has been used in the past. The word cabal, of course, comes to us in English from Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, misunderstood and regarded as threatening by Christians down through the centuries. Whenever a Jewish person in the United States takes a position, it does not mean that they do so as a Jew. And to see American foreign policy as having been overwhelmingly shaped by an organization of Jews is a stretch that has dangerous implications. And I think that we all ought to be aware of that. I referred earlier to the Western civilization's war against Islam. It's important to remember, going back to the Crusades, that when this culture of ours struck out against Islam outside, Western civilization found its enemy inside. The Crusaders, before they attacked Muslims, attacked Jews. And that ancient dynamic, I see it at work again. An enemy outside, increasingly identified with Islam, simultaneously the discovery of a new enemy inside, not surprisingly perhaps, Jews. If anyone tries to blame the current crisis of American politics on Jews, they're participating in the ancient impulse of anti-Semitism.
We're coming to the point where we have a couple of minutes left, and we have some other callers. I'm afraid we're not going to have time to bring them in, and I'm sorry. I want to go back to a point, though, that we touched on perhaps a little bit and have you at least maybe talk for a minute or two about it. And I'm thinking again about the fact that how it is that we here in the United States and the Allies thought about the enemy in World War II and about how it is that we thought of the Nazis. We didn't think about this simply in terms of going up against another state that had a different kind of political philosophy. This was the personification of evil. It was good versus evil. It seemed that it was no less than that. When World War II ended and we went into the Cold War, that we tended to shift that way of thinking to the Soviet Union. And it was, in fact, the man that you, I think with some justification credit, Ronald Reagan, who, after all, said the Soviet Union was the evil empire.
Right.
We're still doing that. We still seem to be framing geopolitics not just in political sense, but in this light darkness, good and evil kind of thing. And if the enemy is evil, well, of course, that means that we must be on the side of right. And that would tend to give you a lot of latitude in terms of what it was that you were thinking that you were going to do. How does one get away from seeing things in that kind of really stark us versus them, you're with us or you're against us, good and evil kind of frame?
Well, I think history is a way to start. That's actually why I've written this book, House of War, which is to look again at what we Americans have done. You know, I'm not whitewashing what the Soviet Union represented over the decades, but what we don't know as Americans, we haven't reckoned as Americans with the terrible mistakes we made. Evil, in my view, is the thing that makes human beings believe they're incapable of doing evil things. Evil is the first signal of evil is the claim to radical innocence and virtue. You can't study what happened in the last 6 months of the United States war against Japan and come away with a feeling of American virtue. It's one of the reasons, as a people, we've found it so hard to reckon with what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But if we look even beyond that to what happened in all of the bombing of Japanese cities, more than 60 of them, in the last 6 months of the war, when hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians, men, old ladies and old men and little kids, were killed by our napalm and, as they called it, jellied gasoline, our incendiary bombs, fires all over Japan. If you look at that, it's hard to look at, but if you look at it, you never can come away with the feeling that America is only virtuous and therefore only capable of good things. And once you understand that, it gives you a large second thought about the rush to war, about the rush to violence, the rush to strike out. We rushed into violence after 9/11, convinced of our own virtue, and we shouldn't have. We should have been much slower to turn to violence. It was a feeling of virtuous victimhood after 9/11 that informed our ready assault against Afghanistan, which led all too readily into our assault against Iraq. And remember how it went. We were convinced of our virtue over against the wicked Taliban and the demonic Saddam Hussein. You don't have to make a case for the Taliban or Saddam Hussein to understand that our motives and certainly our actions and their consequences were not pure and were not only virtuous.
We're going to have to stop there. The book is House of War, The Pentagon, and the Disastrous Rise of American Power.